Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
Hello and welcome to Manx Radio's constituency debate programme, the penultimate one before the election, which is now just a week away. Today, I'm talking to the six candidates vying for one of the two seats in Ramsey. We'll meet them in just a moment. But first, here's John Moss.
Ramsey Town. Has been described as being stuck on a limb when it comes to government spending over the decades. But when it came to Mother Nature handing out the goodies, Ramsey got more than her fair share. With the backdrop of what became known as Albert's Mount after the visit of Victoria and her concert in 1847, and Albert, I'm just going to trot up there, dear, won't be long, keep the pot warm, set off. With the verdant pasture lands of Lozère as a backdrop, and of course the sea and coastline, Ramsey, thank you. Not since Pamela Anderson was a beach so blessed with such a sight. But it's not so much what has happened as what hasn't happened that is high on the electors' agenda when they head for the polls. It was named by the Norse Wild Garlic River. Is that why, over the decades, government has been so sniffy about development up here? In the 30s, after a remark by the then governor on the state of seaside cottages and their subsequent demolition by an enthusiastic council, Ramsey suffered from the piecemeal replacement on that 13-acre site. As a result, it has a bit of a disjointed feel about its architecture. Top of the grumbles, of course, have been since it was closed to passenger traffic in 1970 and to everyone else in 1991, that pier. Yes, nowhere else on the island does an MHK come under such pier pressure. After removal of the above-deck superstructure, and enthusiasts say the pier is a superstructure, the pier has now been mothballed. But for how long? Still with the sea, the harbour, how best to drag it into the 21st century? If a marina, what kind of marina? With the success of other island havens, will the members be under pressure to see something accomplished in this five-year term? Redevelopment. There's a hotel being built on Murrock Promenade by Mr. Hemmings, and the site on Parliament Street is on offer with planning for a 30-bedroom hotel. But will a developer step forward? That site is perhaps the key to progressing the main shopping street's rejuvenation, which has historically more than its fair share of charity shops. Aris, the pipes. The pipes are calling at Balladoole. That work is now underway, and soon Flush and Forget will be forgotten. Crime and punishment. Ramsey has its share of unlawful boisterousness at the weekend in particular. But how do you provide young people with entertainment, but also get the unruly element to behave themselves? The town's been visited by notables over the years. Victoria, King Edward VII, King Henry, even Robert the Bruce. Those last two, because Ramsey was a good place to put into if you were off to somewhere else. Well, who will be representing Ramsey for the next 5 years? Perhaps the next hour will give us an indication.
John Moss. Well, now let's meet the candidates. They are the current Economic Development Minister, Alan Bell, challenger and member of the Liberal Vanham Party, Linda Bowers-Cash, current Treasury Minister, Anne Crane, and independent challengers, Laurie Hooper, John McDonough, and Leonard Singer. As usual, they're now going to have each up to 2 minutes to speak uninterrupted about whatever they choose. This is done alphabetically, so we will start with Alan Bell.
Good evening, Beth, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Since 2008, global events have changed our world beyond recognition. And as these events continue to unfold, they ensure that this is the most important election we have faced for a generation. The twin priorities of rebalancing government finances and stimulating further economic growth and diversity will undoubtedly dominate the political agenda for many years to come. These are massive challenges for us all as the international economic situation continues to deteriorate. But we must not allow ourselves to fall into despair. In the early 80s, we also faced very difficult economic times, and ultimately we succeeded in developing one of the most successful economies in Europe. I was part of the team that developed that recovery strategy. Today, our economy is not in recession and is still growing with very low unemployment, and our rebalancing strategy is currently ahead of expectations. However, high inflation, an aging population, and growing youth unemployment is starting to hurt many sections of our community. The next government must provide the leadership and openness needed to promote a fully inclusive, compassionate and fair society. We must give hope and confidence to our young people that they have a future here. We must give reassurance to our senior citizens that we will protect their welfare and pensions, and our business sector must be given the support it needs to invest and generate new income and growth for the island. And most of all, we must provide the unifying force to heal the divisions which are beginning to appear in our community. This is not a time for populism or false promises that cannot be delivered, only hard work, honesty, and commitment. I believe passionately that if we look to the future with confidence and self-belief, building on our past experience and working together to defend our achievements, our rights, and our values, both Ramsay and the Isle of Man can come through this period stronger and more secure than ever.
Alan Bell, thank you. We now turn to Linda Bowers-Cash.
Well, good evening, everyone. As a former vice president and senior leader in the finance sector and a member of the Institute of Directors, I've observed that nationally, past administrations have not fully embraced opportunities to deliver cost and operational efficiencies or to drive through value for money cultures in government and the public sector. At election time, we must wonder why that is the case. Given that there were 48 findings in the Scope and Structure of Government report way back in 2006. However, we must learn from the past and move forward, being more on the front foot. We must also plan robustly for future expenditure so that we can meet those liabilities when due. The changing global demographics will place increasing demands upon global finances as the world's retiree population is set to more than double by 2050. It is vital that we take steps to care and account for the needs of all of our all generations in our planning, from our seniors through to our younger members of the community. Demonstrating robust and comprehensive financial planning, not only for the next administration but longer term, will send a positive message to external parties who can influence our well-being, such as Standard & Poor's. The USA was dealt a bitter pill and we must be proactive in protecting our AAA rating, being confident and prepared for any review and not complacent. This is good, responsible governance and not scaremongering. How well we drive through change and robust, balanced financial planning will be key to our island's success, both nationally and locally, and supporting the protection of our frontline services we value most. We can and must succeed, and I'm confident that by pulling together we can do so. Thank you.
We now turn to Anne Crane.
Thank you. Politics is about people of every age, shape, size, colour and creed, and the skill that's brought to bear to provide opportunities for us all to enjoy a good quality of life. That comes in different guises across the spectrum, from health, housing and employment, to sporting facilities, culture and leisure. Right now, we're walking a financial tightrope that may mean some of the things that we believe to be important will have to be reviewed, we'll have to prioritise. In doing so, the next government will have to be sensitive and intuitive about those things that are important to people. Bus passes can be a lifeline, pensions a bedrock. These and other services will be maintained through economic growth, and we'll need to enlist everyone who can work to work. But in turn, government needs to create the environment that attracts job opportunities to the island. Our prime focus has to be on economic growth, and everybody can play their part by ensuring that we all buy local. We want to see the continued improvement of facilities in our towns and villages. I'm very proud of the facilities that Ramsay offers, but recognise that our community is disappointed by the condition of some of the retail area. We need to breathe fresh life back into our town, and this will be done by all of us pulling together and supporting one another. Confidence is the key to the future success of our island, our town of Ramsay and us individually. Confidence and sheer hard work. This isn't the time for the faint-hearted, quitters or shirkers. It's a time for strong leadership, vision that will provide a sustainable future for our children and grandchildren, and heart-held commitment. I know what needs to be done, and with the support of the people of Ramsay on the 29th, I have the backbone to do it.
Thank you. We now turn to Laurie Hooper.
Hi, thanks. We need a balanced budget if the island is to maintain its economic strength, and government needs to take control of its finances. We need to increase the efficiency of government while making sure we don't compromise the first-rate service that government departments give the public. We need to look very carefully at where money is being spent. Every time the government spends your money, they need to make sure they're spending it in the best way possible and that they're getting value for money. I think to do this, we need a full review of government spending from top to bottom that includes all areas of our government. There need to be better, more efficient ways of doing things, and these can be adopted. If the private sector or the voluntary sector can do things better, this should be encouraged, and government should be able and willing to outsource some of its services. Now, I don't want to privatise everything. I just want to make sure that government is spending our money in the best way possible, to make sure they're providing us with the best service possible, without it costing more than it should. We're facing some trying times, and whoever is elected must be able to keep an open mind and be willing to look at every way we can close the gap between our revenue and our spending. I don't believe we can close the gap through spending cuts alone. We've lost around a third of our revenue because of recent events, and I don't think that we're capable of making such substantial savings just by reducing our expenditure, nor do I think doing that is the right thing to do. So part of balancing our budget has been willing to look at our current tax system, and by this I of course mean our corporate tax system. We need to remain competitive, but currently our 10% tax band is very, very narrow, and there are a lot of ways that government can extend the scope of the current system. I think a complete review is needed to make sure the system is right for the island. It's worked very well in the past, but times have changed and we need to be certain that the current 0-10 is right for the future. I think government needs to be more open and accountable. I think our Chief Minister should be directly elected by the people of the island, and so should our members of the Legislative Council. How can people trust ministers if they don't directly elect them?
Thank you, Laurie. And we now turn to John McDonough.
Hi, good evening. I've been in Ramsey now for the last 32 years. And my reason for standing is because for the last 10 years, also having a young family, I've grown up in a town that feels a bit left behind. Every day for the last 10 years I've had to traipse through to Douglas, and it's like the town empties every morning. I'd like to see more investment in Ramsey rather than everything being centred in Douglas. Every time we aim for something, it seems to be, you get the general feeling, if it was in Douglas, it would happen. Because it's in Ramsey, it gets overlooked. I would fight for the town, for the people who put me there, and remember who put me there, rather than when they get into the big picture, forget about that. I would like to see a review of the benefit system, particularly on many of the people I've talked to before electioneering and now especially so, are saying that it feels like the people who are on fixed incomes from pensions and people who are working every day and paying taxes and I are sometimes feel no better or sometimes worse off than those who are living on benefits. And there seems to be no incentive to get back to work. I think we can get people out doing a few hours a week voluntarily helping the local authorities. It would help matters greatly and make the town look better. Also, regarding the regeneration scheme, while it's great it's going ahead, I think as things progress we can revisit things and some of the decisions have been made to make sure as we go to each stage it is what everybody wants. Obviously healthcare and education are very important as well, and I've been very surprised as well while I've been electioneering on the extent of feeling of immigration. Not the people are being racist, but there's other people are coming in from outside the island.
John McDonough, thank you. And finally, Leonard Singer.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that you will have received my election manifesto and now know my views on the needs and priorities of the island and Ramsey for the next 5 years. So in this short time, I'd like to tell you a little about me and what makes me tick and what drives me to support and speak up for the people of Ramsey and the island. I have gone through many of life's experiences, good and bad, as I know many of you listening have too. I don't come from a privileged family. Both parents worked in order to ensure the best of their two children, saving to see me through university. So I know how it is to be brought up in a loving family but not have things handed to you on a plate. I know what it means to have gone through marriage and divorce. I know what it means to bring up five children, and I also know how it feels to lose a child. From my many years' experience in national and local government, first in the UK and here for 22 years, and in the pharmacy, and having constantly kept in touch with people, I understand the pressures facing our young people, the lack of opportunities and the inability to afford housing. I understand the pressures facing people with families, juggling their priorities when wages are frozen and commodities are increasing at rates well above the official inflation rate. I understand the pressure on senior citizens struggling to make ends meet, having to dip into any hard-earned savings. And I also know the difficulties of the most vulnerable people in our society who are often not receiving the support they deserve from government. Voting for me will ensure you that you will have representing you someone who is not seeking your vote for self-promotion, someone who is not part of the establishment putting its priorities before those of the people of Ramsey, and someone who will listen to you let your voice be heard, and who we will use common sense and experience to help guide this island home of ours through the difficulties we will undoubtedly be facing in the next 5 years.
Leonard Singer, thank you. Well, I'd like to start today's debate with the issue that's really been the theme of this election, and that's the Common Purse Agreement, the situation surrounding the island's VAT income. Now, it's been suggested by many candidates that the idea of the Isle of Man entering into any negotiations without a firm grasp of key Isle of Man data was unthinkable. Now, Anne Crane, when you gave Timwell details of the new tax-based measurement method in July, you said, and I quote, "The absence of key data means the initial formula will, by necessity, use UK equivalent figures in parts." Now, how does that stand up then to be part of those detailed, robust negotiations that you then talked about?
Well, quite simply, it was a matter of the formula that was changing, Beth, and we don't have that data. We will use UK data for this period of time, but within the two-year period, we're collecting Isle of Man data, and we'll have the opportunity to decide whether we go ahead using that into the future or whether we would choose to continue with the UK data. It's detail, but it came about because the tax-based measure method that is now being used was a completely new method and not one that had we had any experience of previously.
I mean, you could forgive that maybe, though, if it was been the first time the arrangement had been negotiated, but it wasn't. And surely you can understand then the accusations of complacency if 2 years after the first visit, we still hadn't got what it seems a firm grasp on our own economic position with relation to VAT.
Well, we have a firm grasp on our own economic position, but the fact is that the UK government didn't want to use the formula that was there because it was proving to be unsustainable as far as they were concerned. We certainly knew what we wanted to produce out of this agreement. The fact that we took 10 months over the negotiations shows that it was protracted and that it was not going to be something that was going to be a rollover or something that was just going to be allowed to happen to us.
Mr. Bell, when you were interviewed on Manx Radio in November 2010, you were quite adamant that the island wouldn't have to renegotiate the VAT agreement again anytime soon, yet less than a year later those robust negotiations were taking place. I mean, granted, you weren't the Treasury Minister at that time, but how could you misjudge that situation so badly?
It wasn't misjudgment. It was based on the statements which were made at the time by the United Kingdom government. The thing you must remember, of course, the first negotiations took place and were completed in 2007. In 2008, the world changed. We had the credit crunch, world recession, the UK sovereign debt went through the roof. The UK were desperately looking for money from every quarter and, in fact, were reviewing a whole raft of agreements, not just the Isle of Man. They were looking at every mechanism possible to raise money, and that is why it came about. And just to pick up the last point, you must also remember that the VAT sharing agreement is only one part of the wider customs union. And we've been in customs union with the UK now for over 200 years. There's never been a need on either part, because UK haven't got these figures either, to actually get a breakdown of the actual trade difference between the two countries. So it has left us in a difficult position.
OK, who was responsible for the actual negotiations?
My Treasury team and myself.
And so, I mean, there was representation then at political level,
yes,
because there has been a feeling that perhaps it was just left to the senior civil servants.
No,
not at all. It never is. And any of these meetings that take place are fed back not only through Treasury, but into Council as well. Just to pick up on Alan's point as well there, let's not forget that there was a change of government between those two sets of negotiations as well.
Can I just add, Beth, just on that too? I met Alistair Darling twice. I met the UK Treasury Minister several times in the first rounds of negotiations that took place, and Anne met the UK Treasury Minister as well. So there have been substantial political contacts with the UK as well as officer level negotiations.
And those channels are open now? You're quite satisfied.
Absolutely.
With the relationship that we have with the UK as it stands?
Yes, there's a working relationship there and one of mutual respect.
Leonard Singer?
You know, we're getting the same statements again. It was just said initially that the UK government came for the first amount and they wouldn't come back again, and they came back again. We're now told again by Mrs. Crane that this is definitely the final decision. They won't be coming back again. I don't think we can guarantee that. with the UK government.
No guarantees in life, Leonard. But you
said, you said that they will not be coming back again.
I have said.
And you say now they will be.
The UK government was satisfied that we have reached a solid base from which to move on at the moment. But I cannot predict what might happen if we have a change of government in the UK in the foreseeable future.
And I think you actually said, Anne, that they wouldn't be coming back. But I mean, the thing is, what's the face is the UK are not our friends as such. And I understand that the agreement has not yet been signed. Is that correct, Anne?
No, it hasn't been signed. Right.
So I believe that this agreement, in the next 6 weeks or whatever, should go to Tynwald for a full explanation, and then, if they agree, for ratification. I believe the new Tynwald is important that they have a say in what is going on.
But what would you expect if Tynwald turned it down? What would you expect the UK government to do if the message went from Tynwald that we don't like the new sharing agreement?
What would you do if you were in that position? If you can explain it properly to Tynwald that what you've done is correct, then Tynwald will support you.
You've been propagating the idea of renegotiation. Tell us what you would expect from the United Kingdom government if you get elected and you take over that responsibility.
I would expect that we would talk to the United Kingdom. I don't see why we can't talk to the United Kingdom. I think the problem is that we don't have the connections with the United Kingdom that we've possibly had in the past.
Doesn't answer the question. What would you do if you were in that situation?
But it's also an ill-informed judgment. And in fact, what I would just like to point out is that this is an arrangement between government to government, not Parliament. I have no problem in reporting back to Parliament, as indeed we did in July. But this is a government matter.
Linda Bowers-Cash.
I mean, we are where we are with this, and I think the only reason for looking backwards is to look at the learning points. And my observations there, what are the opportunities to have internal reviews for the agreement so that we can prepare for the what-if situations? Do we consider as well where funds aren't guaranteed to be coming our way? What kind of discounting do we do in terms of budgeting? I think that is quite a sensible approach to take. But also, I don't think we can afford to alienate any jurisdiction. And so my thoughts are, is the merit in exploring an opportunity such as the US Virgin Islands have with the US Congress, where they have a non-voting representative who can lobby and speak directly with the members of Congress? These are some things that, they're just ideas, but I think...
Are they liberal Bannon ideas?
Well, they're ideas that have been expressed in the past, and it doesn't really matter whether they're Liberal Vannon or whoever's ideas. If they've got merit to them, then they're things that we can consider. Because
I'm trying to get at is this actual Liberal Vannon economic policy in the 6 points of the 7-point plan.
With the consideration of a US US Virgin Islands style representative, it's not in directly in our manifesto. But just because it's not in the manifesto doesn't mean to say that it's something that we shouldn't consider. And I think I really would like to say that if we're going to get through the next 5 years and the economic challenges, it really is about constructive debate and pulling together and finding out the solutions that's going to work for the island.
Constructive debate, talking with the UK, not being told. It is about
constructive debate, but I would just take a little bit of issue with what Linda's proposing, because let's not forget, we are a nation here, we're a country and our own entity, and yet we seem to be suggesting that we should have a representative in the UK Parliament. Let's get clear what we're talking about.
The US Virgin Islands have a similar status to the Isle of Man. They have no voting rights in Congress. Yes, we are independent, but... it's not that I'm suggesting that as a fait accompli, but it's an idea.
I want
to
bring in Laurie Hooper here. I mean, you believe that the current financial situation is down to a lack of planning, but we've got reserves in the bank. There's a programme of driving through more efficiencies in government that's already underway. How can that be described as a lack of planning?
The reserves in our bank don't even come close to covering things like our pension deficit. Mm-hmm. How can you turn around and say we've planned for the future, we've definitely got a secure financial base, when our debts effectively are so much greater than what we've got in the bank?
Okay, so what's the plan that you have then for going forward and sorting that situation out?
The key thing government has to do is it has to find a way of raising additional revenue. And whether that is through looking again at the VAT agreements. I'm not saying we go back and redo what's already been done, but I'm saying we look forward and say, what's the next step? What is the right step for the Isle of Man going forwards? Do we need to renegotiate? Do we need to go it our own way? We need to look at everything and say, right, this is the best thing. The other option for increasing revenues is, of course, changing the current tax system. Now, we've got a very narrow zero tent here. We only tax banks and income off Manx rent, I think it is, rental income from land. There's so many other places, so many other types of companies that we could raise revenue off. Tax is effectively a game the government plays called what can we get away with? How much money can we take out of the economy without seriously damaging or without damaging the economy in any way? And that's the aim. And for me, you've got to look at every single part of the economy. Why don't we look at sort of retail branches of UK firms? They pay tax in the UK. Why isn't that tax coming to the Isle of Man? It's not going to affect the firm so much.
They can affect our 0-10 regime.
You must not lose sight of the importance of the 0-10 corporate tax structure for the Isle of Man. It is absolutely fundamental to the success and growth of the economy. If we were to lose the zero rate of corporate tax, we would lose a huge number of jobs, which frankly would destabilise the island economy and Manx society in the process.
It was only recently we had the 0-10 come into play. Originally it was exempt companies, so you had a similar... Why don't we move back towards that, where nearly every company is exempt except for the ones that we can tax without damaging the economy?
Because we have to prove to Europe and the United Kingdom that the Isle of Man tax structure is not harmful to the domestic economies in Europe and to international companies. If we restructure the 0-10 structure now, we will put at risk thousands of jobs on the Isle of Man without any exaggeration at all, and that would lead to meltdown. There is no easy solution to this. On paper, it might seem straightforward. It is a very dangerous step to take.
John McDonough, your view on the 0-10 tax structure?
Yes, certainly I agree that if we can, there is among many people that the off-island retailers operating on the island, people are going spending the money there, but then we're getting no benefit of it. The only tax we're getting off them is the tax on the night from the employees, who aren't greatly highly paid anyway.
Yes, and people enjoy using those retail units here in the Isle of Man. They do create employment, and what you've got to consider is what Alan has just been saying, the fact that if we start to alter the tax regime for those particular individual companies, we put our 0-10 regime into danger. And that's what we've got to avoid on the international standard front with the EU Code of Conduct and so on, because that will put jobs in jeopardy.
Have we made any contingency plans for other routes, though? Or are we just saying the 0-10s, that's
it? At the present time, the 0-10 is important to us, but of course we've got other things to consider.
Look, though, at the success that the Isle of Man has had, only in the last week or 10 days, where the Code of Conduct Group have now recommended that the removal of ARI from our tax system then gives credibility to our zero rate, and the zero rate will not be under attack. If we make any further amendment to that structure, then the zero rate will be back on the agenda again, and the economy will be under direct threat from Europe.
Leonard Singer, I'm interested about how you can be so critical of a government that really you were part of 5 years ago. There were no warnings about a possible economic crisis in your 2006 manifesto. You knew as much as the other MHKs seemed to at the time. The current situation is unprecedented and largely down to the global situation.
I agree on it. I'm not criticising some things that government do are really good. There's lots of business brought in, particularly on the economic side, new business opening. But we are having great difficulties for lack of forward planning in certain areas. Waste of money. We know there's been a lot of waste of money. There's been little investment, if we come back to the town, to bring the economy better. I will support the government when they're right, but I'll certainly criticise them when I think they're wrong.
Okay, but if you're so concerned about the lack of progress of the last 5 years, why did you resign from LegCo when you had the opportunity to work with us over the last 5 years, with Mrs. Crane and myself, to help Ramsay and to help the Isle of Man as an additional vote to get us through what have been unprecedented difficulties economically and external threats to the island?
Alan, it was a matter of principle resigning, because you and Anne said that you supported the 24 hour service. I don't want to come really to talk this.
We have always supported the Cottage Hospital. It's never been under threat.
You said you supported in both your manifestos.
Yes.
Said, we support the 24 hour service at the hospital.
Correct.
And after the election, we heard nothing, and that's when we had money.
And surely we would have been much better staying in government rather than resigning.
We're moving away from the subject. We're talking about. Okay, we're talking about government spending, and I want to stay on that subject. Leonard Singer, you refer in your manifesto to the ineffectual smoke and mirrors 2011 budget. Justify that statement.
The budget came after the £140 million was first grabbed. I know that it was reduced by £25 million because of the extra increase. But we were told at that time we have to pull our belt. Everybody got to pull their belts in. who's been, nobody's actually pulled their belts in since the budget. But I think we'll all are going to be told after the election how we're going to have to pull our belts in. And I just hope that it's going to be fully spread amongst all society, not at certain sections.
Treasury Minister. It's quite extraordinary that when you come up with a budget through difficult times where adjustments have been made and you think you're going to have to use reserves, and after 1 year into the five-year plan you find you don't, that this is described as a smoke and mirrors budget. I would say that's a damn good budget, quite frankly. And if there was a fault at all, it was that it was so well devised that it hasn't impacted into people's lives and had a shocking effect. I think actually you are undermining what was a very good and positive budget, Leonard.
Anne Crane, you do say in your manifesto that now we will have to be much more focused on where and how we spend our monies. Now, that does give the impression that spending until now hasn't necessarily been that carefully considered.
I believe it has. Over the last period of change that we've had with the transformation of government, we have made inroads into all areas of government in the delivery of services, centralising procurement, bringing together services such as the state's finance, HR, all of those things are making a difference. I think that we will have to go further, and I think that we are going to have to look at the scope of government.
Absolutely.
I mean, in your manifesto, there's a great deal of explaining about where we are now, but there don't seem to be many policy ideas. You say we must continue to diversify to promote economic growth, but that doesn't really mean a great deal to the person on the street, does it? How are the people of the Isle of Man, the people of Ramsey, going to be affected by future economic policy? That's what they want to know.
What the people of Ramsey are going to see over, and it will take some time because we have to rebuild our economy again, but they will see continued investment in the town. As I've stated also in my manifesto, there's a renal dialysis unit to come through, an EMI to open, the sewage plant to come on stream. So all of those things will trickle through. But the position at the present time is that it is going to be difficult for us to rebuild our strategy. We are going to have to look at all areas of government in terms of, absolutely everything, terms and conditions of employment, benefits, the way in which we do things. And so there's an awful lot to do.
Laurie Hooper.
I'd just like to say, really, that you're talking about now we need to make these changes. My question would really be, why haven't these changes already been made?
Why haven't there been
a continual sort of a way drive to improve efficiency and value for money throughout the past, not just the past 5 years, but the past 10 or 15 or however long? Why is it now that it's taken a crisis point to reach us that we have suddenly woken up and decided we need to react? I think you need to be much more proactive about these kind of things.
Linda Bowers-Cash?
I'd like to look at the reports and make observations, and some of the observations in the basic expenditure and activity review process by the Timbal Stand Committee as recently as 2010-11. I'm not sure that people are getting the message as strongly as they need to be in the public sector about driving a culture of value for money. I think this is where we absolutely need to have better traction. And for example, if you've got 600 pages of departmental returns with only 10 lines of reported proposed reductions in spending, overall increases of staff of 253, somewhere along the line, we need to be better at driving that culture of cost efficiencies and value for money. So, I'm not pointing fingers, but what I'm saying is these are indicators that we're not actually quite on the money for this. Pun intended.
You're listening to Manx Radio's constituency debate programme, and we'll be back in a couple of moments.
Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio, brought to you by PDMS.
Welcome back. This is Manx Radio's constituency debate programme. I'm Beth Espy, and today I'm talking to the six candidates standing for election in Ramsey. They are Alan Bell, Linda Bowers-Cash, Anne Crane, Laurie Hooper, John McDonough and Leonard Singer. John McDonough, I want to stay with the issue of spending for a moment. You talk in your manifesto about wasted government expenditure, using the example of why does all office furniture have to mash? I mean, surely that's just getting bogged down in the detail.
But no, I mean, if you can make small savings like that, I mean, I'm sure like various departments have got stores of old furniture. If you're not customer facing, why does all your desks have to?
Well, the furniture doesn't match in my room. Whose room does it match in, John?
Well, I understand £3,000 was spent refurbishing your office, Mr. Bell.
Not my personal office, absolutely not. It might have been decorated, but.
And then another thing, like regarding spending on the sewerage, Iris has been going on for over 19 years now, and now how sewerage trickling through is going to help Ramsey, or the people of Ramsey, a new sewerage work. How does that impact on the town?
It will mean that we won't have our shores polluted at the current time.
It will have a major impact on the town of Ramsey. I have tried for years to break away from the All-Ireland IRIS scheme and have a local solution to it. We've now got that. Work will start next year on that. That will help not only clean up the beaches, it will also take the pressure off the existing sewerage scheme in Ramsey and enable the town to grow and develop in the future.
Why was IRIS ever given the go-ahead?
Sorry?
Why was IRIS ever given the go-ahead?
Because it was 20 years ago.
Okay, John McDonough, I just want to stay with the issue of spending with you. And you also talk about the advancements in technology, saying there's no reason why satellite offices can't be established out of town. Use the outsourcing of driving licences to the post office as an example. But surely with such an emphasis now on reducing the size of government, this focus has to move away from the traditional face-to-face delivery methods and look at embracing what you call those advancements in technology and bring more services online, for example.
Yeah, the danger is, given the island's ageing population, you're always going to have some people who don't want to traipse to Douglas to do things, which is why things are being outsourced. But then sometimes someone might get a form through or a letter through from the government and they don't even know what question to ask, and they don't want to pick up a phone and say, and press one for this, two for that, or use the internet.
But we can't go about increasing headcount around the Isle of Man.
Just move offices around on a fortnightly or a weekly basis, one day in town somewhere, so people can make appointments.
I know you talked about online. I had a case recently of an 80-year-old woman who received some information, and it wasn't the full information. And when I asked about it, they said, oh, it's a bad form, isn't it? The lady can download it. Well, it was impossible for the lady to download. Can I say one other thing? That I think that rather that we do need an office in Ramsey, a government office, that deals with all items of government, so people can walk in and deal with anything that happens and they have connections.
Anne Crane.
Well, correct, Leonard, and that's why we're trying to establish one-stop shops out in the regions, and it is to make that personal delivery.
Not correcting me, I agree with it. That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Work is already underway on that and has been for some time.
Where's that?
On the principle around the island.
Alan Bell, I mean, you say it's time to think smarter, not bigger. There must be no sacred cows within government. I mean, those are undoubtedly sensible statements, but the devil's in the details. So tell us when and where these reductions are going to be made.
Yeah. First of all, I do not support at all the concept of slash and burn, and it's not helpful to the Isle of Man, either socially or economically, to go into this reduction too heavy-handed at this stage. It could destabilise a great deal. We've had restructuring. Whether that's the right thing to do or not is debatable. But fundamental, and I think Linda touched on it just now, to any change in government, any savings of money, is changing the culture of government. That's where the root lies. You can have any shape, size, colour of departments, structure you want, unless you change the basic culture, the way we deliver services, engage the frontline staff, not just leave it to management to actually change things. The frontline staff know where savings can be made on a daily basis. We have to start there from the bottom up, not from the top down. And I think that will engage the whole team. We have to work together on this if we're going to be able to get through it. Because frankly, those same frontline staff, if we don't make those savings, those jobs are going to be at risk. So there's a major imperative there for them to...
The Department of Economic Development's been cited time and time again by various candidates as the main tool, really, in the island's armoury with regard to promoting economic growth. Is it up to the job?
I think so. It's taken us about 12 months to get the department together. We were physically in 9 buildings to begin with. We are now all under one roof. We've streamlined them, we've reduced the staffing headcount, and we are now drawing up the strategies for the different sectors to get going. We've recently restructured finance. We are now working on a country strategy to develop financial services. We've just been to China. We've had a very good response from that. We're looking at new sectors on a regular basis. There is new business still coming into the island. I think we're not quite there yet, but the new department will be in good health, I think, when the new government takes over to actually take this forward.
Is it true your department threatened to withdraw funding from Rally Isle of Man if they didn't move from its original date from the middle of summer to autumn in an attempt to extend the tourist season?
There has been discussions with the rally organisers now for the last 2 or 3 years.
Did you threaten to withdraw their funding?
I haven't threatened to withdraw anyone's funding. But the important thing is every single event that government is involved with, my department is involved with now, has to add up financially. It's not that the gravy train for a lot of organisations is finished. They have to bring a tangible financial return in cash return and visitor arrivals to justify the ongoing expenditure.
But then why put the money in if you're not going to back it up?
We need to know that the event is capable of delivering the end product that we are trying to achieve. The money will go in if we know it is capable of generating new business for the island to keep the tourist industry growing. Because in the meantime, we have a limited amount of money for events. There's a danger that we get stuck in events which, frankly, have no further ability to grow at the expense of new events which we can develop. For example, we've had the end-to-end mountain bike event at the weekend. There are over 800 visitors to the Isle of Man just for that one event. There are new events developing all the time, and we should look at that. We can't get stuck in the past. What is, I keep saying, and from 2008, the world has changed and everybody has got to accept that.
Okay,
the old way of doing things are finished.
Let's move on to another issue. I've said it numerous times during these debate programmes, but openness has been a real buzzword during this election. Not new, I suppose. I can't think of many elections anywhere where people don't talk about openness and transparency, but we still haven't got freedom of information legislation, Alan Bell and Crane. That's really done very little to inspire public confidence in the past administration. It really has given the impression that there's something to hide.
It's very interesting, this, because actually this administration has been much more open than any ever before.
It's not saying much, though, let's be honest.
Well, what is it that you want to know? Our summary of proceedings are out there. They're available. There is information on the websites and can be made freely available to people in written form. I find that this quest for freedom of information to be somewhat puzzling, because I think if the questions are asked, the information is there.
There was no mention of the financial implications regarding freedom of information in the original consultation document. So how did it suddenly appear in the 2011 Bill's explanatory memorandum?
This is based on the experience in Jersey when Jersey brought their freedom of information bill in. They estimate that it cost Jersey somewhere between £2 and £3 million to set up the infrastructure there. I think the concern we have here at a time when revenues are tightening because of VAT and various other things, if we are faced with a similar bill of £2 million plus to bring in this infrastructure, that will have to be drawn away from another.
Okay,
head of,
well, in the service. United Kingdom, there's a 4-year delay to implementing Freedom of Information Act 2000. So, if having the Act over here was really all about cost, why not get it on the statute books and make it workable law when the money's available?
And it is. I mean, it's had its first reading in the last session. Admittedly, it was late coming through. It will be on the agenda in October, November when the new Keys sits. And I would very much hope that that'll go through. I think it has probably almost unanimous support in the Keys, and you will see the Freedom of Information
Linda
Bill
Barrett
very shortly.
Cash.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that I think it's important externally that a jurisdiction is seen to have a transparent government, and that's actually demonstrated and demonstrable.
But the fact is, can I just say that the big issues are debated in Timwood, right? The public has full access to those sittings. If the people are interested or concerned, they can go along.
What I was going to actually say was agencies such as Transparency International will give a rating for a jurisdiction. And the Isle of Man actually hasn't got its own rating. We're probably lumped in with the UK. Now, these are important factors when people are looking at us for investment purpose and so on and so forth. So, you know, these are aspects that we should be taking into account.
We need to recognise, though, that the Isle of Man government has had a code of practice on freedom of information. Although the legislation's not been there, the code of practice has been there for quite some time. And in fact, under that code of practice, there have been very, very few refusals ever of requests for information. So there's a lot of nonsense being spoken about this because, as Mrs. Crane has said, the information is there in 90% of the cases. And there will always be areas of commercial sensitivity, political sensitivity, and so far as our dealings off-island are concerned, which have to stay confidential.
OK, let's move on to the issue of Ramsay itself. And there does seem to be a huge divide between what the MHKs of the past 5 years believes happened with regard to investment and what all the challengers think. Laurie Hooper, you say the town's been left behind, but how is £62 million worth of investment in the past 5 years being left behind?
You've got to ask where the investment's going. And I mean, we've built new schools. That's great. Don't get me wrong. I think the schools themselves are amazing. But when you look at Ramsay as a town, where's the work? Who is going to be filling those schools in 10, 20, 30 years' time? You know, if people can't work in the town, people are all working in Douglas. People aren't going to want to live in Ramsey. I mean, I don't know very many people from sort of business community where I work that actually live in Ramsey.
You don't live in Ramsey?
I don't. No, my family do. I grew up in Ramsey. I wouldn't live in Ramsey if I couldn't afford to. And right now, it's going to cost me just as much to rent in Ramsey as it does in Douglas, where I can walk to work. There's no petrol costs. There's no transport costs. And a lot of people are suffering this because they're choosing to live in Ramsey because it is a great place to live. But the problem is, you can't encourage businesses to come to the town if you're not building them purpose-built office blocks, if you're not giving them the infrastructure to help them set up.
I'm interested in what you also say about the government. You want the government to play an active role in bringing entertainment to the town. Now, you cite the Centenary Centre in Peel, but that building was restored and is now run by volunteers.
It is a completely voluntary organisation. That's right, and the government should be supporting voluntary organisations that want to do this. We've got, there is a new Northern Lights Centre setting up in Ramsey, which is looks brilliant. It's set to bring music and entertainment, and I'd imagine the government is supporting them with funds. And if they're not, they should be.
On a personal basis, bring a week of entertainment to Ramsey, and I don't recall seeing you at any of it, Laurie, but I mean, with Ramsey National Week, it does come down to people actually doing things for themselves. And, you know, we all have to pull together as a community. These things like entertainment centres, I'm afraid, are not things that government can actually provide.
Government can be supporting the voluntary organisations that want to set them up.
Indeed,
I'm not saying
can.
That government should fork
government
out money
does.
And hand over.
And government does.
John McDonough, I want to bring John McDonough in here. I mean, you can't expect government to do all the work. People have to take on some of the responsibility for improvements themselves. There's been talk about the retail element of Ramsey. There is a 50% grant scheme available to people who want to improve the look of their shopfront, but only, what is it, six people have come forward to that? What else can government do?
Yeah, well, I mean, it needs to go out there and shout about it and make sure what's available.
But people have to help themselves at some point, don't they?
Yeah, they do. But then if government, as I said, if the government had a one-stop shop, it's like, yeah, I was talking to the general manager of the bowling alley, and he's had to go through, jump over hurdles to get set up.
Leonard Singer, you say...
He has to go through no more hurdles than any other business setting up in town.
But why can't we as a government make it easier for people to set up?
There were problems, Alan pushed in front of, on planning, they kept coming with planning, which, objections, which actually weren't objections. And in the end, they had to admit that. And they said quite clearly they wanted that bowling alley in Douglas.
No, they did not.
They did. Rubbish. They did. Did they not?
Yes.
That is a fabrication.
Because they,
that was said that the bowling alley. With
planning kept putting
the planning,
objections.
I'm not going to turn around and say they want a bowling centre in Douglas.
People
it's not planning's role. You know perfectly well
no,
that's
I didn't
not
say planning. People
you
wanted planning. Douglas. But planning kept putting up objection after objection. And the commissioner kept saying, well, that's not an objection. Why is that an objection?
OK, I just want to, a very quick question to both Alan Bell and Anne Crane. I mean, you've both held very high ministerial office. It would be true to say we haven't often heard you and Timor banging the drum for specific Ramsey issues.
I don't think that that's very fair, Beth. Actually, when you look at my manifesto and you see the amount of investment commitment that has been made to Ramsey, I think that our banging the drum goes on in Council of Ministers and is proven by the amount of money that is there and enhancing the town.
Can I ask about the
Ramsey
amount of money?
Gets
is that
mentioned
comparable?
At every opportunity during debates and behind the scenes in the Council of Ministers and in department work. Certainly both Anne and I have both been in Treasury for the between us over the last 10 years. Treasury is extremely influential in getting this development going ahead. Without the support from Treasury ministers, you certainly wouldn't have had the £60 million that you've got in Ramsey in the last 5 years.
OK, final point on this, Leonard.
Well, the £62 million, though, it's not brought to any investment to increase our economy. As I said, the schools, the swimming pool was very, it's very badly designed. It could have been designed much better. The houses on the Lazare estate, that's not put one new person into a house. It's just replaced.
But it's improved the quality of life.
Of course it has.
You are on Ramsey Commission. You know how bad the quality of the housing was on Lazare estate.
Don't say we shouldn't have built them, Alan, but
don't
claim it as being investment to increase the economy in the town. It's not.
It's been vast it's investment replacing. To improve the infrastructure
well,
of the town.
Well, it had to be.
And
that wasn't just this last 5 years, because I was involved in that before as well, the planning of all this.
OK, I just want to move on to another issue before the end of the programme, and that's the notion of the Chief Minister. And it does seem, according to a recent survey, that there is public appetite for a popularly elected Chief Minister. There's also a strong belief amongst the majority of you here that that should happen. In fact, Laurie Hooper, in the Manx Radio Political Questionnaire, you say your national priority, if elected, would be to make sure that happened along with a popularly elected Legislative Council. Now, given all we've heard about the state of the economy, the need to rein in finances, you think that tinkering with an issue that may not even come up again before the next election region is a priority.
Yeah, I think you have to do these things whilst there is the political will to do them. It needs to be done. You cannot have a leader who is not democratically elected by the people. That is
inherently wrong. The Chief Minister will have been elected as a member of the House of Keys and therefore has a mandate.
Tony Brown was elected by the people of Castletown. People in Ramsey did not have a say in whether or not he should be an MHK, which means that
the UK didn't have a say in Gordon Brown becoming Prime Minister.
No, but they knew they were voting for a party. And they knew who was the leader of that party.
But when you are elected, you take on the responsibility of your constituency
that's
and you elect through an electoral college.
That's you need to understand here, though, there is another issue here which is much, much more important. If you have an all-Ireland election for a chief minister, you are appointing an extremely powerful person.
Exactly, which is why the independent...
That's very good. You should have an extremely powerful chief minister.
And then if you want to get rid of him, how do you get rid of a chief minister who has an all-Ireland mandate when you are a member of the House of Keys with a tiny constituency base?
Surely that's
but
up there.
Alan Bell, if the public do want this, surely if you're their elected representative, it's your duty to bring it about. I mean, what are you so afraid of?
It's not being afraid. We have to look at the practicalities of how this works in terms of the overall electoral purpose. We need to have a clear view in the round how this is going to work, what the consequences are going to be on a future government.
I want to just bring in Linda Bowers-Cash quickly on this.
On this, I do believe that we should have a publicly elected chief minister. I believe that the public have a right to elect that position because of the very nature of it and the remit. And I think that's just...
And finally on this, John McDonough.
Yeah, I'm absolutely in favour of it as well. How can you have someone ruling? I mean, the last time, Mr. Brown, I feel it was more of a dictatorship.
Okay, finally, Lynn.
The one word is not why it can't be done, it's how it can be done, and I believe it can be done satisfactorily.
Okay, that brings us almost to the end of the programme, so just time for each of you to outline why you deserve the vote on September the 29th. Again, we'll do this alphabetically. We'll start with Alan Bell.
Yes, we are entering extremely difficult economic times, which will have a major impact on the Isle of Man. I believe I am the most experienced minister in government. It's my experience, leadership, I hope, compassion, hard work and commitment to the people of Ramsey and the Isle of Man over the last few years, 30 years in fact, will give me the ability to represent them more effectively.
Linda Bowers-Cash.
Yes, I want us to protect what we value most. And I've got the skill set and a proven track record in driving change and driving value for money and the experience. Therefore, I feel I'm very equipped to help to do that.
Anne Crane.
I care about Ramsey and I care about the Isle of Man. This isn't a time for an apprenticeship for people coming in. It's too crucial at the moment for the economy and the condition that it is. We need experience and I'm that candidate.
Laurie Hooper.
I've got a passion for the Isle of Man. I really care about what happens to Ramsey as a town and the island as a whole. I think I've got the drive and the enthusiasm to make sure things get done. I think that's important.
John McDonough.
Yes, I will put Ramsey first, obviously, because they're the people who put me there and that's where I live. And given, although it said it's no time for an apprenticeship, given the record of the past couple of governments, I couldn't think I could do any worse.
And finally, quickly, Leonard Singer.
Well, on my doorstep, I know people are concerned about the way the island's been run over the last 5 years and particularly how the heart of our town has been allowed to deteriorate this election. Please use one of your votes for me because I will make sure that over the next 5 years, by voting Singer, your voice will be heard as it was before.
Well, thank you to all the candidates who've joined me today. Roger Watterson is going to be back with a final programme tomorrow, speaking to the six candidates standing in Russian. If you'd like any more information about the election, you can visit Manx Radio's dedicated website, election.manxradio.com. For now, goodbye.